Dr. Sturdivant has been the Deputy Director of History for the Air Force Space Command. He's a nationally recognized authority on U.S. military space history. He appears frequently as a guest lecturer on aerospace history topics, in addition to writing classified official histories that none of us are privy to read. He also has published numerous book chapters, essays, articles, and reviews. He serves on the editorial board of Quest, the History of Spaceflight Quarterly, and is editor of the International Academy of Astronautics History Series. His presentation today is entitled Aeronautics and Astronautics, Pioneering Air and Space Business in the Pikes Peak Region. Please help me welcome Dr. Rick Sturdivant.
And we're going to fly like a rocket through some of this. This is about a century and a decade's worth of flight into the air and then on into space. And what we've tried to do up there once we've gotten there, wherever there is. So here we go. I pointed that? Yeah. Okay, the first heavier-than-air attempt to fly in the Pikes Peak region, as some of you might know, was by a man named William B. Phelps, sometimes attributed to as a confidence artist. And he went by the title professor, but I doubt that he had a degree like mine, or Dr. Olson's. Anyway, he attempted to fly a glider in 1897 off the summit of Pikes Peak. And in August of 1897, there were thousands of people assembled in the Broadmoor area waiting to see Professor Phelps come soaring down from the peak. Well, how far do you think he got after? He hauled this apparatus, which was made out of bamboo and about 225 feet of silk fabric covering these condor-like wings. How far do you think he got? 12 feet. That was the vertical distance from the top of either the signal station up there or the summit house. The accounts vary as to which building he jumped off of. But it was 12 feet vertically. Now, one of the interesting things about this is after he disappeared right after this, he decided to go for a walk and never came back. Some people said he went to the Klondike. But at any rate, a couple of the Cog Railway workers reported that they brought his apparatus down and tried to fly from a little bit lower elevation on the peak and claimed that both of them had actually been able to go about 200 feet. I don't know that that's been confirmed. Anyway, gliding flight became very popular in Colorado Springs, and in the 1929-1930 period, a company known as Alexander Aircraft, we'll talk a little bit more about them later, was using spare parts from their biplanes to build gliders for training purposes and for recreational flight. And so here you see one of their advertisements for a glider. There were, in this period, glider clubs were very popular worldwide. And throughout the United States, you'll find lots of newspaper articles in this period where glider clubs are being formed. And guess whose gliders they were buying? Alexander Aircraft. Here you see one of their gliders flying over Austin Bluffs. Well, gliders weren't the only way that we could get up there. And this guy, Jim Blanchard, in 1891, even before Phelps, had patented what he considered to be a propelled bicycle with a kind of canopy over it. And you'd start on a ramp with this thing, pedal as fast as you could, and when you were airborne, you see the propeller on the back, keep pedaling fast if you're going to fly, right? Well, I'm not sure that Blanchard ever tried this. He was a Colorado pioneer. He came here in 1859 originally, but in the gold rush, and he was a miner. There was a man named Joseph Hirschenfeld in about 1904-1905, right here in Colorado Springs. Blanchard was in Denver. Hirschenfeld had a similar kind of invention, but I don't think that he ever flew either. But it's kind of a fanciful thing. Another way of getting up there, of course, was lighter than air flight with hot air balloons or gas-filled balloons. And aeronaut Ivy Baldwin, his real name was William Ivy, but he had flown with the Baldwin brothers back in Indiana in balloons, and so his stage name, if you will, was Ivy Baldwin. He came here into Colorado in about 1890. In 1893, he was doing balloon flights at Elitch Gardens. He attempted a Transamerica balloon flight. He had put an engine on his balloon, And in November 1907, with a couple of passengers, he took off from Denver. How far do you think he got? And the dream here was to do all of these things by going over Pike's Peak. Well, he went over Pike's Peak in this balloon, a gas-filled balloon, but didn't get very far as transcontinental flight was concerned. He crashed on the west side of the mountain in a storm. But ballooning remained very popular in the Pikes Peak region. Here in Colorado Springs in 1912, as part of the Shawn Kiva carnival, summer carnival that they had in those days, there was a transcontinental balloon race. Three major aeronauts with their teams were trying to fly and beat the 1,200 mile distance record, which was then the distance record for hot air balloon or for gas-filled balloons. And how far do you think they got? They took off from Washburn Field here in Colorado Springs, and the farthest one, the winner, got as far as 6 miles south of Castle Rock. Oh. Yeah, yeah. The others crashed up near Larkspur area. But as we all know, the Colorado Balloon Classic, organized here in 1977, it's still ongoing. And so we know that hot air ballooning and gas-filled ballooning remain very popular. Certain times of the year, you know, we have the commercial businesses where we'll all hear kind of a and we'll look up, and there will be a tourist in a balloon in one of the commercial flights as well. Also, a lot of us don't think of balloons as unmanned or unpiloted vehicles, but here in Colorado Springs, and this is just recently, at the beginning of this century, we have helium-filled high-altitude balloons that are being manufactured right here in the Springs and for communication and surveillance purposes, both commercial remote sensing types of things, commercial communications. These balloons can go up to 80,000 feet, and they can hover up there at that altitude for months at a time. So you can think in terms of intelligence purposes, they could be very useful in the military sense. But in terms of monitoring wheat fields or something like that, you know, at even several thousand feet, you can see hundreds of square miles. So very important, and probably in the future, even more important, a balloon-related aerial enterprise right here in the Pikes Peak region. Well, then, of course, we know that there were lots of people who thought if we could just, and Phelps was one of these people in the glider sense, if we could just do powered flight like a bird, maybe we could get up there. George Davidson was a Scotsman, and he had this idea of an air car. In the 1880s, and you see him up there in the upper left with one of his models, he had studied the flight of birds in Scotland. In 1900, he came over to Denver, and he started communicating with the Stanley brothers. His idea was that he could make a steam-powered 20-ton vehicle like this that could carry a couple hundred passengers. And here you see that's the schematic of it. And he'd be able to fly passengers from Denver to Chicago and then from Chicago to New York and back. So he started promoting this idea in the 1890s. Around 1907, he started building his steam-powered air car up in Denver, and by 1908, he had finished it to the point where he thought he could at least test it. Now, May of 1980, he cranked up the steam engine. He started building about 200 pounds per square inch of pressure, and what do you think happened? The thing blew up. And this was a 10-ton contraption, and it just scattered parts all over the lot there. Well, he was out of money at that point. Did he give up? Well, yes, he did in the United States. But he went back to England, formed another company, and kept trying for another dozen years or so. Of course, as you might imagine, not too successfully. So the first successful heavier-than-air flight in Colorado was by a French aviator, Louis-Paul Hahn, in Denver in February 1910. And there you see his airplane. And it wasn't long thereafter, in fact, some people think that George Thompson up there in Denver, a teenager, was actually working on his airplane when Paul Hahn flew. But by mid-1910, George Thompson, a teenager, had built his first biplane. He sold it to a man named F.A. Pine, who was involved in mining up in the Victor Cripple Creek area. but lived here in Colorado Springs. It wasn't too successful, but reports are that Pine eventually improved on it and got it to fly. Well, Thompson learned from that manufacturing experience, and he built a second airplane for the Mathewson Flyer for Elin Mathewson. Mathewson formed an airplane company. Now, Elin Mathewson was a race car driver and owned a big automobile business in Denver. And so he had a lot of money, and Thompson proceeded to fly for him in exhibition flights around Colorado until 1912, down in Lamar. A little gust of wind tipped the airplane upside down, and Thompson tried to jump out as it was approaching the ground. Unfortunately, the plane landed on top of him and killed him. Now, accidents, flight safety in this period practically didn't exist. A lot of these early aviators were killed within 2 or 3 years of learning how to fly. So, but there you see in the bottom here, you see his first flight up in Denver. And that occurred and was reported in the press in February of 1911. The first flights here in Colorado Springs, actually right here in the Springs, were by two Wright aviators, Phil Parmalee and Cliff Turpin, out of Roswell Park. And this was in conjunction with the Shawn Kiva Carnival in 1911. Here you see some of the newspaper coverage. And actually what they were trying to do and what it was billed as was flights over Pikes Peak. The Wright brothers had, Wright Aircraft Company, had built two airplanes, the Pike and the Skylark. Specifically, they thought powerful enough to be able to climb over Pikes Peak. Well, that didn't happen, but Ute Chief Buckskin Charlie, down here, and can't see it very well from the newspaper, actual picture, but he got to sit in one of the biplanes. And so there you have, you know, the Colorado Springs past with the Colorado Springs present. And here's just a little bit larger version out of that front page. You see people with the liniment bottles and things like that because they'd strain their necks trying to watch the airplanes. These guys were pretty smart because they had enough sense to find a good slope and lie on their backs so they didn't strain their necks. And of course, the peak is welcoming the aviators. Parmalee, when he was interviewed, and this is in the newspaper report, he said he had no doubt. He'd been able to fly up as far as Garden of the Gods, through the entrance to Garden of the Gods, with his airplane. Now, this is about 40 horsepower engine. And so he said, if I get a little more powerful engine, I can probably do this, not a problem. What these flights did, both Paul Hans and the Parmalee and Turpin flights, they inspired a lot of other people along Colorado's Front Range. And here, Billy Parker up in Fort Collins, he was 13 years old when he built his first plane in 1912. And right here in Colorado Springs, as far as I know, there were no other aircraft flights after Parmalee and Turpin in 1911 until 1914. Winfield Bowersox in 1913 went back to Dayton, and he got his pilot's license at the Wright Flying School. And he talked with Orville Wright about the possibility of flying over Pikes Peak. And Orville said it would be difficult, but with a powerful enough airplane engine, he thought it was doable. So Bowersox came back, started looking, and I don't know if this is the ad he answered, but in Popular Mechanics, in March of 1914, there was an article for a Curtiss biplane for $300. I think that's the ad he answered, because in May of 1914, this airplane that you see right here arrived, and here he tells his story. There he is sitting in it, and it arrived. The Colorado Springs Company had gratis given him some land west of Papeton and just north of the Colorado Springs city limits. They said within an easy walk of the end of the streetcar line. And he built a runway up there, and he was building a hangar, and he became the first Colorado Springs resident to actually fly, as far as I know. As you can see from that, he gave exhibition flights around Colorado and in the Dakotas and Nebraska, crashed 7 times, and he's buried up in Evergreen Cemetery. He managed to survive those crashes. World War I brought a lot of change and brought some inspiration. And so Frederick Buck, who was out in Flagler, had this idea. Some of you might have heard of the Kettering flying bomb. Well, Buck's idea was similar to that. And in 1916, he pioneered and patented the Buck automatic torpedo. He created a company and settled in Pueblo with that company in January of 1917 to build airplanes and to build these flying torpedoes. I don't know how successful his company was, but it's innovative. And as some of you might know, toward the end of the war, General Electric engineer Sanford came out and Sanford Moss tested his Liberty engine, supercharged Liberty engine up on the top of Pikes Peak. And there you see them standing up there. And there's the apparatus that they drove up to test. And then World War I produced a lot of aviators. Alexander Lindrum completed the first actual flight in an airplane over Pikes Peak in 1919. He was flying a Curtiss Oriole for the Curtiss Humphreys Company up in Denver. He also was the first one to pilot an airplane to Rocky Mountain National Park. Of course, in the 1920s, commercial aircraft business took off big time. And most of you have probably heard about the Alexander Film Company. They were in Spokane. They made movie films. And the two brothers, Don and J. Don, decided that maybe it would be a good idea if they centralized their operation in some place like Denver for the distribution of these films. And then they could make a big publicity splash by flying their films into these small towns around the Midwest and the West on airplanes. So they bought a company. They had a guy named Al Mooney designing an airplane for them. And by 1925 up in Denver, they'd formed the Alexander Aircraft Company to build their own aircraft. And then other people were interested in buying those airplanes. So they needed to expand. And in 1927, this is the layout that they proposed. And the boosters here in Colorado Springs said, well, we've got some land for you. Up there, just northwest, if you go to Nevada and Fillmore intersection, northwest, the Channel 11 KKTV studios are still in part of the old Alexander Film Company buildings. The aircraft portion of it burned down in the 50s, the final building. And there you see a postcard image. There's an inside of the factory. There's some of their planes on the outside. At one point, they were producing almost 8 biplanes a day. They were the world's second largest airplane manufacturer, and they were the largest airplane manufacturer in the United States for a brief period of time. And then, of course, you see 1929 and what's going on, the Great Depression. And so bankruptcy sets in. There's one of the Eagle Rocks that's up hanging in the Denver airport. If any of you have flown through there, you've probably been able to see that. They kind of made a mistake, and this is shortly before they moved to Colorado Springs. A guy named Charles Lindbergh, he used to come up into northeastern Colorado and fly for an uncle that lived up there, and he found out about the Eagle Rocks. He was contemplating a flight across the Atlantic, and he came to the Alexander brothers and asked them to build an airplane for him. Well, because they were so busy turning out these 8 biplanes a day, and this was a very lucrative commercial enterprise for them, they said, well, we don't have time to shut down our assembly line to build a special airplane just for you. So of course he went to Ryan Aircraft instead. But he wrote a letter and he continued to promote them. And here you see the tall guy right here. That's Lindbergh, a little bit later, out at what's now the Peterson Air and Space Museum. There's one of their advertisements. They also developed experimental planes like the Bullet, which was a monoplane. And there you see racing pilot Edith Folt. She set a bunch of records in the Bullet. It was a very dangerous plane to fly, but it had a retractable landing gear, and it could reach an altitude of 19,000 feet. So it flew with 600 pounds cargo over Pikes Peak at an altitude of 19,000 feet. Well, they went bankrupt, but several of their mechanics sort of bought what was left of the company, and they formed Aircraft Mechanics Incorporated, AMI. There you see in the 1950s, again up just off of Nevada and Fillmore was where their building was. They're still in existence. After World War II, they got a contract with the government to study the German ejection seat technology. And they became the manufacturer of most of the ejection seats for U.S. military aircraft. They still are. They also produce thousands of flight attendant seats for commercial aircraft. And they produced the seats for the space shuttle, the astronaut couches. Well, what do you do with these airplanes besides hold exhibitions and flying carnivals and things? Well, the airmail, of course, came along in the 1920s. There you see a couple of covers I was able to purchase of the first airplane flights for airmail from Cheyenne to Denver, Colorado Springs to Pueblo and back. And as I said, a lot of these early pilots were killed, especially in bad weather and flying in conditions and geographic places that they weren't familiar with. So one of the barnstormers and early pilots, a guy named Elry Jepson, was involved in this. And he'd been keeping a black book. And he started the Jepson Company. They're still in business making aerial navigation charts and using the global positioning system, for example, to make flying safer for pilots around the world. By the 1990s, more than 90% of the world's airlines and pilots depended on Jepson navigation charts. And the building of small commercial and civil aircraft remained an enterprise in the Pikes Peak region. Most of you have probably heard of the Aircoop, very famous private type airplane. And from 1950 to 1959, those were produced here in Colorado. First up in Denver by Univair and then Forney up in Fort Collins. And right here in Colorado Springs, Bud Maytag, who went to Colorado College, he's from the Maytag Appliance Company, heir to that. He formed in 1950 the Maytag Aircraft Corporation. And then, at this point, they are the world's largest supplier of what we'd call logistical services at airports around the world, particularly for military airports. He also went on to purchase and own Frontier and National Airlines. And there's a lot of story we could do a little talk on him. Well, up in Denver, about 1954 or so, they became interested at the University of Colorado in designing what are called pointing controls for rockets. And they started with sounding rockets. And what they were doing, they were putting a pointing control on there so that what's called a coronagraph camera, which takes pictures of the sun so that they can detect sun storms. They had to hold the camera stable even though the rocket was oscillating in its flight. So they began producing those things. Then in Boulder in 1956, a small company came in. There was a fruit jar company named Ball back in Indiana, Ball Canning Jar Company. And the Ball brothers wanted to diversify their business. So they bought a small scale company named Control Cells and in Boulder. And then they hired away some of the engineers and scientists from Boulder that had been building those pointing controls. And they started competing with the university. And then they got a contract with NASA to build the first orbiting solar observatory, the OSO satellite. They built a whole series of these up there at Ball Aerospace. And the thing that's interesting about that is, once again, what's the OSO satellite to do? It's to study solar weather, to study the storms on the sun. This is related to what they were doing with the pointing controls. And I think we all know that Ball Aerospace has developed into a major corporation. They made the hardware that fixed the Hubble telescope. Remember when the Hubble telescope first went up? It was all blurred. The images were a real disappointment. Well, look at them now. And that's because of what Ball Aerospace up in Boulder was able to do. And there they are today. Actually, 10 years ago. They're probably bigger than that now. Well, something else was going on. And Martin Marietta, in the 1954-1955, the United States decided that we needed to build an intercontinental ballistic missile fleet. And the Atlas contract was given to Convair Corporation out on the West Coast. But Defense Department officials were a little uncomfortable with that, and they wanted to have an alternative to the Atlas. It would be the Titan ICBM. And they wanted that produced somewhere in the interior of the United States, Why? Because they felt that the coasts, either east or west coast, could be attacked more easily. It would be more difficult for the Russians to send an ICBM if they got one first, as far as Denver. And so Littleton, near Denver, Colorado, became the home of the Glenn Martin and then later Martin Marietta facilities up in Waterton Canyon. And there's the interior of one of their plants where they're producing Titan rockets in the 1960s. There's one of their test stands up in the Red Rocks beyond Waterton Canyon. And Martin Marietta got into building satellites just like Ball Aerospace did. The Viking Mars lander in 1974. In 1976, when it landed on Mars, it became the first spacecraft to actually give us images from the surface of Mars. And that was built right here in the Pikes Peak region. And they continued up there to build launch vehicles for space systems. There you see the Titan IV and the Titan II. And larger interplanetary spacecraft like Galileo and Magellan. And they became the producer of most of the spacecraft that we use, that NASA uses, in Mars exploration programs. There you see the Mars Surveyor. There are just several of the other types of Mars landers and Mars orbiters that have been produced right up there in Littleton, Colorado. And now what are they doing? They're building the human spaceflight replacement, oversized Apollo capsule is what I call it, but it's the Orion. And here just 2 months ago, they're removing the heat shield from its mold. That's the largest heat shield ever produced in the world. It's 16.4 feet across. And these companies, Lockheed Martin, Ball Aerospace, and Raytheon that's up there in Aurora, got involved in commercial remote sensing, taking pictures from space that give you 1 meter resolution. And some of you might recognize where this is. I-25 in the Broncos Stadium. Yeah. And so they're, you know, the Pikes Peak region at this point, just north of Denver, is the country's focal point, if you will, for commercial remote sensing. And the military has obviously gotten involved in this. Space Command was created in 1982. That's where I've worked ever since 1985. And that has brought a lot of business to the region and a lot of military presence. We moved from the Chidlaw building in 1987 into the Hardinger building, and that's our headquarters. And Schriever Air Force Base, it was originally Falcon, was created out east of here. All of the military satellites that we own in the United States and some of the NATO satellites as well are controlled on orbit from this place, just a few miles east of here. And then what was going on, McDonnell Douglas was building Delta rockets down in Pueblo. The interesting thing about this is that for a brief period of time in the 1980s up into the early 1990s, most people don't know that all of the major space launch vehicles that this country used, not just for military launches, but for any space launches, were produced right here in the Pikes Peak region. Okay? And they put up things like the Global Positioning System satellites that have become so important. These are a global utility. They're controlled by Air Force Space Command on orbit, but they provide timing and positioning and navigation information to people all over the world for all kinds of uses. And see that 911 down in the corner? There is a woman-owned business here in Colorado Springs named NAVSIS. And the 911 application, so that if you get in trouble and you have your cell phone, the emergency responders will know where to find you. That application was developed by NAVSIS right here in Colorado Springs. And of course, the social networking. All dependent on GPS timing. So there we have it.
We're going to come back down to Earth and take another drive with our next presenter, Judith Reed Finley, who is one of my favorite local historians. Judith received her MA in French Literature from Colorado College, and she recently retired from her longtime position there as coordinator of the oral history and photograph collections at the Special Collections Department at Tutt Library, Colorado College. She was deeply involved in the opening of the Century Chest Project at CC in 2001, and as a result, published an edited and annotated version of those 150 letters and many photographs in the Century Chest Letters of 1901. She's also authored other publications, Time Capsule 1900, and Coming of Age in Colorado Springs, 1945 to 1955. Today, her presentation is provocatively entitled, Hustling the Tourists, Early Automobile Sightseeing in the Pikes Peak Region. Please welcome Judith.
Thank you very much. In thinking about the theme of this symposium, I came to the conclusion that the automobile was really the biggest influence on life in the 20th century. So my presentation will explore how the automobile greatly expanded the opportunities for sightseeing in the Pikes Peak region after 1900, thanks to Spencer Penrose and other visionary entrepreneurs. First, a little bit of background. Even before automobiles came, our town was already a prominent tourist resort. And in the 1880s, Victorian travelers could arrive by train and settle in at the New Antlers Hotel or the romantic spas of Manitou, and then they would set out to explore Cheyenne Canyon and the Garden of the Gods. And they especially marveled at the beautiful beauty of Pikes Peak towering to the west. Now, early tourists were willing to endure the strenuous trip to the top of Pikes Peak along a carriage road, which was completed in 1887. The tourists would board the new Midland train to Cascade, where the road to the peak began. And there, from there, they would board Hundley's stage line at Cascade in horse-drawn carriages. They'd go as far as the halfway house, which was up below Glen Cove, present-day Glen Cove. And then they would have lunch and rest before going onward, now pulled by longer-winded mules. The idea of a cog railroad up Pikes Peak came to fruition in 1891. When trains began crawling up the Ruxton Creek drainage, a total of 9 miles to the summit. But this innovation, you can imagine, made the old carriage road rather obsolete. People preferred to go up on the train, and the carriage road fell into disuse. Now, when the first automobiles appeared in Colorado Springs at the turn of the century, the enterprise of taking tourists up the mountain really began to change. You can see the Bernard livery sign there. That's sort of an outmoded way of talking about automobile automobile livery. That's a little strange today. Anyway, the newfangled horseless carriages came along, and with Pikes Peak as the focus for tourism, it was inevitable that this mountain would be conquered by automobiles. This pair of adventurers, Mr. Felker and Mr. Yount, actually reached the summit of Pikes Peak in a steam-powered locomobile in August 1901. It took them 3 hours to go the first 2 miles. Actually, this was sort of a publicity stunt, but publicity stunts notwithstanding, the public demand for better roads grew rapidly, and good roads associations were formed throughout the country. As early as 1905, the El Paso County Good Roads Association hired prominent landscape architect Charles Mulford Robinson to come out from New York. He was supposed to make recommendations on the development of the Colorado Springs streets. His report recommended putting landscape center parkways on many of General Palmer's original wide avenues. This seems a little bit ironic this summer, looking at the deplorable state of our center medians. Anyway, Mr. Robinson emphasized that the principal function of the streets in this resort town should be, quote, as an outdoors room, inviting people to loiter there, sit in the sunshine, and enjoy the view. The word automobile was not mentioned at all. But the automobile was here to stay. It certainly was. And drivers demanded roads. Practical considerations resulted in the establishment of a state highway department in 1910 with a budget originally of $40,000. And this shows the growth of road construction through the next decade. El Paso County began to use convict labor to improve roads. And I think Katie referred to convict labor that was used to build that highway down to Texas, too. And during 1911, an estimated 6,000 autos from other states visited Colorado. And one adventurous family took 11 days to drive from Iowa to Boulder, Colorado. They had to follow farm roads along section lines, like this, opening and closing gates. And they had to buy their gas in hardware stores. There weren't any gas stations. The local brochure pictured in this slide could be considered an early version of a GPS system. It had very detailed milepost logs, and they contained such descriptions as sand draw around corner, turn to right, follow telephone line to railroad station and turn to left, go down long hill, cross bridge, etc. Very detailed. So obviously, the need for paved roads increased as automobile ownership increased. Here you can see the motor car registration numbers in El Paso County. And by 1926, these had gone up to more than 11,000, so it really grew rapidly. But it took pressure from wealthy businessman Spencer Penrose to get much action about better roads in Colorado Springs. In 1919, Penrose offered to pay a third of the cost for paving a road from South Nevada Avenue to the Broadmoor. The resulting street had the distinction of being the longest stretch of pavement in southern Colorado in 1920. By 1926, the state of Colorado had a big total of 191 miles of paved roads, and the road to Denver was not completely paved until 1928. Spencer Penrose was an early fan of the automobile. As early as 1902, he had paid $12,500 to acquire a fancy French vehicle. That was a lot of money at the time. And this kind of fascination with the automobile obviously influenced his later activities in promoting tourism through the automobile. He was very astute as an entrepreneur and innovator, and he really did see the potential quickly for automobile tourism. In 1915, he obtained a 20-year lease from the Department of Agriculture to construct a new auto toll road to the top of the peak along the right-of-way of the former carriage road. And private machines ascending the mountain had to pay a toll of $2 per passenger with a $4 minimum. That was pretty good business for him, and he got a lot of big publicity for his new auto highway throughout the country. Penrose then turned his attention to building a hotel of his own to lure tourists. His elegant 1918 Broadmoor included a fancy garage and a fleet of touring cars to carry guests on sightseeing tours throughout the region, particularly along his new toll road. His Pikes Peak Automobile Company published glossy brochures which touted the grandest scenic highway in the world. I don't know if you can see the details on this slide, but it's typical of the kind of publicity that highway got. Now, to augment his original fleet of cars, Penrose ordered brand new white brand automobiles in 1918, and later in 1922, he switched to Pierce Arrows. By 1926, he could boast a fleet of 60 sightseeing vehicles owned and operated by the Broadmoor Hotel. I like this picture because it shows the streetcar tracks there. I think John Haney would appreciate that. It's important to remember, though, that well into the 1920s, most tourists still arrived in Colorado Springs by train. Only a few sort of adventurous types dared to tour the West scenic spots by car. Motorists coming to Colorado received warnings to equip themselves with crowbar, hatchet, shovel, pulleys, rope, cans of oil, gas, water, and most important of all, chicken wire to spread over mud holes. You saw those pictures of the roads in Katie Rudolph's presentation. They're pretty bad. So with such warnings, it's no wonder that tourists preferred train travel to driving. Besides, the sightseeing buses that met them at the railroad station and the tour cars offered experienced drivers who had a knowledge of the Pikes Peak region's tourist attractions. Now, I did a lot of research through the Penrose papers, and they're full of correspondence which show that Penrose took advantage of every opportunity to expand his stake in the sightseeing business in the Pikes Peak region. For example, I found that in 1918, he was exasperated that only the buses of the Wandell and Lowe Transfer Company were allowed to approach the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad Station. So he asked permission of the railroad companies for his six white vehicles to pick up passengers there. And evidently, this was granted. When the Wandell and Lowe people objected to the buses with the Broadmoor name on them standing in the station, Penrose co-opted them by threatening to cut off their existing contract for baggage transport to the hotel. He drew up an elaborate contract for them to take over the passenger transport as well, paying the Broadmoor, of course, 90% of the take. And in 1922, this resulted in the establishment of a yellow taxicab company by Wandell and Lowe, and Penrose had a big stake in this company for several years. Intense competition between Penrose's Broadmoor and the Antlers Hotel, which was managed by George Krause, resulted in cutthroat efforts to grab the tourists as they stepped off the trains. So-called baggage checkmen were employed by hotels to ride the trains, ostensibly to arrange for baggage transfer, but surreptitiously they were advertising the advantages of staying in their hotel and booking their hotel sightseeing tours. In May 1923, the owners of 11 Colorado Springs hotels petitioned the railroad companies to abolish baggage checkmen. They felt these guys were monopolizing hotel transfers allegedly in favor of the Broadmoor. And Penrose accused George Kraus of the Antlers of instigating this petition because he was jealous that the Wandell and Lowe Company was getting more business than his own Antlers Livery Company. This is the kind of competition that went on. Regarding the baggage so-called checkmen or train riders, it seemed that the practice of train riding continued in spite of railroad efforts to curtail this practice. Now, my own father was employed by the Alta Vista Hotel in 1928 as a train rider. He would take a DNRG train west to the Royal Gorge, which is pictured here, and then he'd stop at the hanging bridge where the eastbound trains would be coming through, and he'd wait several hours and hop aboard an eastbound DNRG train to solicit the business of incoming tourists. Penrose was so competitive that he managed to acquire the Mount Manitou incline in 1915, the Pikes Peak Cog Railway in 1925, and he also got control of the Crystal Park Mountain Highway at the same time. That road, if any of you have ever been up it, had such tight hairpin curves that there had to be a turntable constructed to move the big Packard touring cars around at Inspiration Point. Penrose also obtained the Colorado Springs franchise for the Gray Line Motor Tour Company. And when his contract for the with the government for the management of the Pikes Peak Toll Road expired in 1935, he tried hard to convince the feds to extend his lease. He even asked the Forest Service to grant his Pikes Peak Automobile Company the exclusive right to haul tourists to the summit. That's a whole nother story. The road was finally taken over in 1936 by the Forest Service for a few years. Penrose never did have the sole right to the sightseeing business. Tourists who came to Colorado Springs had to run a gauntlet of fast-talking, aggressive tour car operators in the 1920s. And many of these guys were independents who owned their own cars, such as Hap Mercer in this photo. And chaos reigned as these guys jockeyed for position at the railroad station hack stands. The most notorious person among them was Nora Ma Gaines, the only woman in the hack business. She was a throwback to the days of the horse and buggy. She drove a horse-drawn fringe surrey and practically snatched the Flatlanders as they got off the train. She could swear like a trooper and drive like the devil. She was a master at stealing business from her competitors and very raucous and uncouth. But even so, she was secretly admired by the other tour drivers. They really liked to hassle her and heckle her, but they liked her. She kept her buggy whip at the ready. Now, in addition to the tour cars, hotel buses competed for the attention of arriving visitors. One of the first rules when tourists arrived in this cutthroat atmosphere was, grab his luggage, the tourist will follow. And at one time during the 1920s, 8 Colorado Springs hotels operated free buses during the summer months. You old timers here will remember all those downtown hotels with names beginning with A. There was the Acacia, the Alamo, the Albany, the Alta Vista, and the Antlers. And in 1921, rates for single rooms without bath ranged from $150 to $5 a day. This is from the Elk Hotel, this slide, a brochure. They were located on the north side of Pikes Peak Avenue between Tejon and Nevada. Now, the city was very strict about trying to regulate the enterprising tour car drivers, and they established licenses and fees and so forth. And by law, these drivers were not supposed to stray more than 10 feet from their vehicles or call out in a loud voice. but these city ordinances were openly and constantly violated. The city also set up maximum fees for sightseeing trips around the region. They had 34 different tours specifically listed in the city code, and the auto tour to the summit of Pikes Peak cost $8.50 per passenger. Private enterprise relished the many opportunities for making money off the booming tourist business. And here are some of the brochures that various sightseeing opportunities presented to tout their special attractions. And inevitably, there was the photo opportunity. The Flatlanders loved having their pictures taken at the summit of Pikes Peak or at Glen Cove. Say, notice the snow in this one. Glen Cove in their big passenger touring cars. And this was obviously a source of income for enterprising photographers. Harry Stanley was involved in this business for a while. Of course, not all the visitors to the Pikes Peak region booked sightseeing tours or stayed in hotels or boarding houses. And thanks to Henry Ford and his inexpensive Model T, which was developed during that era, more Americans began to afford to buy automobiles. And as highways gradually improved, many travelers set out to see the sights in the family car. Camping became a popular vacation choice, still is. Municipalities throughout the nation began to offer free camps for automobile tourists, such as one established at Prospect Lake in Colorado Springs. This was around 1920. But by 1924, the Chamber of Commerce urged the city to start charging fees in line with what other communities in Colorado were doing. And throughout the nation, paid camps, cabins, or cottage courts, as they were soon known, came into vogue. I did a survey of Colorado Springs city directories through the 1920s, and you can see from this chart the local growth of auto camps and tourist camps around the region. It was interesting to me that the very first so-called tourist camp was the El Colorado Lodge in Manitou. Most of you know where that is along the road west. Tourists began to want more creature comforts, as we all do as we get older. And the Mountain View Cottage Camp at 1703 South Nevada is a good example of the trend that moved toward motels. They began to put curtains in their windows and that sort of thing to make people want to stay there. Now, we all know the results of the expanding automobile culture in the United States. But who in those early days from 1900 to 1930 could have predicted the growth of a national network of freeways after World War II? And who could have imagined the evolution of the mom and pop cottage courts into the large chains of elegant motels that are available to travelers of the 21st century? But in spite of all the changes in those years, it's important to remember that the sightseeing business hauling tourists around the Pikes Peak region has never really died out. The Gray Line Tour Company, now international in scope, still continues to operate in the Pikes Peak region under the management of Chuck Murphy, whom many of you know. And its tours are widely advertised on the internet. The Broadmoor Hotel remained proud, too, of its own fleet of touring cars throughout the years. At the end of the century, the Broadmoor still operated 30 to 40 vehicles and employed about 30 drivers. But in 2001, they finally decided to get out of the transportation business and they leased their state license to Ramblin Express, which is the company that goes up to Cripple Creek a lot. Nevertheless, in spite of all the changes, even today, the spirit of Spencer Penrose, entrepreneur extraordinaire, lives on. He was really the man who started it all when he saw the potential of expanding automobile tourism in the Pikes Peak region. Thank you very much.